The story, I Was Your Enemy. The board meeting of the church I served veered from normal discussions of business to the hottest topic of the day, the court trial that soon would begin. I could never be a juror, one attested. If I were on that jury, I would hang every one of them. That man they killed was my friend. Well, they were referring to the federal trial of some KKK men over the firebombing death of a black leader in our town. Since I had just arrived as pastor, this meeting offered great insight to their hearts and thinking. The ineffectiveness of the state's system of justice brought the federal government in to investigate and then try the accused on less-than-murder civil rights charges in order to gain some justice. Though it was a common topic of conversation, the embarrassed town cast their glances aside as they watched all the defendants convicted. When the trial was over, the press of life forced the event from my mind. I didn't know that that trial would revisit me on several occasions, even 25 years later. The whole subject came flowing into consciousness just a few months later, actually. One of the pastors of the city had a radio program that was the best I had ever heard. He taught the Bible with a joy, insight, and thoroughness that proved that the author was his best friend. I met the man on numerous occasions and grew to love and respect him. One problem. He was black. In this town, still racked by Ku Klux Klan influence, friendship with him had some costs. I spoke of him one Sunday morning in my sermon. After describing him and my respect for him, I told of how I longed to spend time with him and to have him stick his feet under my table. But I knew the atmosphere in the town. They may burn the parsonage and the church down, and that house and this church building are not mine. They are yours, I stated, and I have to keep that in mind. From the front row and the mouth of one of my deacons shot an answer that continues to ring in the halls of my memory. He said, "Pastor, let it burn." Shortly after that, I left that town, wandering even farther away with memories growing ever dimmer. Then, 20 years later, in a flash, everything came back. I was teaching at a mission school in Hawaii when I overheard a tall, wiry student state that he was from that city where I had served 20 years before. I made my way to him, smiling, to reveal that I once lived there. He asked, "When and what did you do?" "Oh, 1968 and 69. "Pastor," I listed. "Then I was your enemy," he responded. "I was one of the men convicted for bombing the house of the black leader, killing him. I became a Christian while I was in prison." After regathering myself from the shock, I told him the stories of my days there. Friday brought our goodbyes until we ran into each other at Chicago O'Hare Airport about 2 months later. 5 years passed with no further contact or knowledge until another trip to Hawaii for another school. The leader of the school asked me if I hadn't lived in this certain town. With my positive response, he rushed to his office and brought me a book by this man. He said, "I think you'll find this book very interesting." Indeed, I could not put the book down as the inside story of Ku Klux Klan activity was revealed. One most interesting development. The author, who now lives under a different name, decided not to turn damaging evidence of KKK activity over to the police, but promised that he would if they ever committed any violence again in that state. Ooh, you can hear the quiet. Discussion. Do you ever distrust the conversion of someone in prison? Number two. Do you think jail is enough price for some crimes, or should restitution be made? Why? Number three, if you were to sit in jail alone for a year, what changes would you expect in yourself? The story, A Skull Versus Stripes. A summer like any other summer, 1969. I grew accustomed to emergency calls. Pastors do. This one was intense. The breathless caller informed me that the son of one of my parishioners had lost control of his motorbike on a gravel curve and had flown headfirst into a pole at 50 miles an hour. He was on his way to the hospital where his newly informed parents were headed also. I arrived shortly before them and watched as the teenager was unloaded from the ambulance. Blood and mud covered his face, which twitched in constant seizures. I feared for his life. By this point, the whole church was being alerted to pray. The family, once they saw him, returned to the waiting room and sank into a grieving stupor. Comfort has its limits in the absence of information. After praying for them, I wandered back to the X-ray room and watched as they carefully held him rigidly and turned him for X-rays from different angles. The doctors were waiting for the results. My familiarity with the hospital and its small-town casualness gave me much freedom. I knew where the X-ray viewing room was and quietly walked down the hall toward the door about the time I knew the film would be ready. The door, slightly cracked, permitted all the view I needed. I heard them whistle in disbelief as they placed the film against the lighted viewing plates. Even from my view, the results were obvious. A split the width of my little finger ran the entire length of his skull from front to back. The doctors became aware of my presence and closed the door. I alerted the parents to what might be coming up. The doctors took an envelope filled with the film and walked immediately out to the parents. "We're not equipped to do anything for your son," they reported. "We'll place him in an ambulance and race him to a much larger hospital 100 miles away at the state capitol. Hopefully they can help. We're shorthanded on nurses. We have to find one to accompany him." Finally, a nurse from surgery, a dear family friend, volunteered to ride with him. The father also rode in the ambulance. The mother rode with me as we raced along to keep up with the speeding, flashing lights ahead. The talk was serious. The tears, frequent. The anxiety, high. The questions, many. The prayers, constant. Only in our hopes could he live. Then the stripes gained control. How can you explain those moments when you just know something to be true, though you have no evidence? I simply knew. I turned to the mother and said, "Your son is okay. He's going to be all right. I just know." She was afraid to hope that much. Later, the nurse accompanying him could not tell the story without crying. She said that she always wanted to see a miracle, but never thought she'd be monitoring the pulse when the unbelievable happened. His life signs had been steadily deteriorating as they raced along in the ambulance. She was afraid he would die before they arrived, but suddenly his pulse and blood pressure stabilized and became normal. She could not explain because nothing was actually being done for him. She's merely tracking his progress as they traveled. By the arrival time, he was conscious. The doctors checked him in, looked at his X-rays, took new ones, checked his bleeding, looked again, and marveled. They said, "You're actually okay. You only have bleeding in the scalp. Except for the fact that there's a half-inch gap in your skull, we'd send you home. But we need to watch you for a while. This is hard for us to believe, since we just sent home as a vegetable a man with just a small skull crack." We were almost afraid to believe. When I visited him later in the hospital, his eyes, barely able to peek through his swollen face, sparkled. He said, "You know, I even feel smarter now." A week later, he came home. Though it was still summertime, we declared the next Sunday to be Thanksgiving. Applause and praises greeted his entry that Sunday. This was not Turkey Day. This was Thanksgiving. Oh, by the way, His grades, miserable until then, greatly improved. Let me read from John chapter 19 and from 1 Peter chapter 2. He went out to the place of the skull. Here they crucified him. By his stripes ye were healed. Discussion. Number 1. Describe any experience you have had of God's healing. Number 2. Have you had a crisis experience that improved your life or attitude? How? Number 3. What would you like to see God do for you now? The story? The fleece. Gideon started the whole controversy. God told him that he would free Israel, and Gideon acted on that information in a way that put him in fatal collision course with the enemy. Then he suffered pangs of doubt and put a sheepskin on the ground, asking God to make it alternately wet and dry opposite to the nearby ground's condition, so he would know that God had authorized him to do these risky things. So we've taken that act of doubt and formulated a whole theology. To put out a fleece is common lingo in action. But we have a problem. What constitutes a good fleece, and indeed, if any fleece is good? Weirdness permeates the whole genre. For instance, I heard of a man who said, "I'm putting out a fleece. I'll know God wants me to divorce my wife and marry my secretary if the sun comes up tomorrow." Give me a break. Now, everyone recognizes the absurdity of that fleece, but here's one that strikes closer to home. Adrian Plass speaks in his hilarious diary of a fleece that he felt a need to put out in response to a request by his church. They asked him to join them in ministering to the poor in downtown London. He answered something like this: "Well, if at 4:45 a.m. tomorrow a man shows up at my door dressed like a Japanese admiral, I'll know that God wants me to help you." Sure. Or even closer to home, the prospective university student, frustrated in making a school choice, makes his fleece this: "The next letter I get from a school will be the one you want me to go to." Yes, I know, that's miserable decision-making. However, I must tell you of a fleece of my own. I planned for years to be a surgeon, but now as a college freshman in a time of prayer and contemplation, God was offering me another option. Preach. I knew it was him, and the whole issue became settled in my heart. Then in a moment of mental weakness, I decided to put out a fleece. God, I don't have an automobile. And you know I can't preach without an automobile. Now, I don't know where it says that in the Bible, but anyway, I'll know you want me to preach if you supply me with an automobile. Feeling smug, I returned from my place of prayer to my dormitory. If I had been listening closely, I would have heard God chuckle. 1 week later, here came my car. You could hear it for a mile. It sounded like the pistons were trying to change holes in mid-cycle. My father was driving. Now, you need some additional information here. My father had suffered extensive brain damage in an accident 12 years earlier, but had retaught himself to drive. Alone, he had driven my car 150 miles to this university. "Son, about a week ago, I had the strongest feeling that you needed a car." Oh, I was melting. "I have some friends at a used car lot who tell me this is a good car." "Friends?" I mentally questioned. He handed me the keys, then reached into his pocket and handed me the documents. I quickly flipped through them and then stared in disbelief. The payment book? He handed me the payment book. I would never have bought this car, but now it hung around my neck. No, it hung around my wallet like an albatross. Fleece, fleece, chuckle, chuckle. That car tried me. Driving along at night, suddenly all lights would go out. You had to place your feet carefully or they'd go through the floor. I had to park the car on hills at night so I could get it rolling fast enough to start in the mornings. On cold mornings, as I pushed that car, I could hear the Lord chuckling and asking, "Are you going to do that to me again, Gail?" Never. Never? Never. Discussion. Number one, how do you know when you have heard from God? Number two, what methods do you use to verify His voice? Number three, have you ever felt that some method you used to hear from God failed you? Describe it. The story, 12 Steps. It was a dark and stormy night. Okay, cliche, but that's exactly what it was. I had gathered two of my parishioners, willing to brave the wind and rain and drive to a country church where a denominational gathering would occur. We arrived before anyone else, and the pastor, who lived next door, joined us at the front of the sanctuary, just to chat. Time passed, and the storm worsened. We paid little attention because of the pure pleasure of the fellowship. Finally, we realized we would be the only ones there, all three of us. We continued our chat with the pastor there on the front pew of the sanctuary. At 7:30 p.m., the pastor looked at his watch, took the 12 steps up to the pulpit, donned his sanctuary voice and said, "It's time to begin. Get out your songbooks, turn to page 230, and let's really sing." We looked at each other and wondered what had happened in those 12 steps that had changed his voice and his manner so dramatically. Discussion. What do you think causes a sanctuary tone? Number two, what do you do because it is the traditional way? Number three, how do you feel around someone who is often in the public eye? Are you surprised if they are different in private? The story, The Bag Man. I always liked Sunday nights as a pastor. Casualness coupled with fewer time restraints permitted me to teach larger portions of Scripture as we would go through different Bible books. Because of my style of teaching, I usually stood down in front of the platform and near the congregation on Sunday nights, as I was doing on this particular occasion. I was about 30 minutes into the teaching when it happened. From the back door, I watched a man carrying a large paper bag enter and walk steadily down the left aisle of the auditorium to the front row of pews. He sat about 20 feet to my left. Anyone entering that late grabbed everyone's attention, including mine. His paper bag rattled noisily as he shifted around so he could reach the contents. Our eyes fastened to each other as I tried to continue the message. He reached into the bag, pulled out a large knife, and laid it on the floor. I watched closely and kept talking, although few people, I think, were listening. Then he reached into his bag and pulled out a gun and laid it on the floor beside the knife. Now he truly had my, our full attention. Then he reached once more into the bag and pulled out a Bible and laid it on the floor beside the knife and the gun. Well, to continue with this distraction would be pointless, so I stopped to talk to him. "I assume this has some meaning," I began. "Yes, I'm trying to decide which one of these I'm going to use," he responded. By now I'm thinking more rapidly than usual, though not necessarily more clearly. The church elders assured me later that they were prepared to jump to my defense, though I lacked evidence of that at the time. Somehow the addition of the Bible and the sheer openness of the situation caused me to realize that he was not a present danger to anyone. So I encouraged him to just sit there and listen as I finished my message. I'd be glad to help him decide afterward. Sure enough, as we talked, the question had to do with danger, not to me, but to himself. We discussed his relationship with God, and he decided to become a Christian. We let him keep the Bible. Discussion question. Number one. Describe some times that you felt that you were in physical danger. Number two. We all have fight or flight decisions to make at times. Which one tends to rule for you? Number three. What methods do you use to avoid conflict? The story, April, May, June. Names and locations are changed in this story for obvious reasons. Her looks, as well as her name, April, May, June, won her the award of Calendar Girl from a fraternity at the University of Avalon. I knew her, because her dad and she frequented my grandparents' house during the time I lived there. Almost every holiday they would be at our house during family meals. They seemed to have no regular home and would occasionally, for extended times, stay with my grandparents. When my grandfather described April's father as a man with a millionaire's brain and a pauper's bottom, I felt that I had all the information I needed to understand the situation. My grandparents also numbered as friends a wealthy family who owned a major manufacturing company. Their son, Jerry, and I became good friends, though he was about 7 years older than my tender 14. I considered him one of the finest people I had ever met. Well, April, May, June liked him too. Really liked him. Oh, forgive me, but I could not and cannot get my grandfather's brain-bottom comment out of my mind. April won her prize, and she and Jerry were married. Her wedding dress exceeded the word finery. These events made it appear that all her dreams, and perhaps her dad's, were being fulfilled, until a moment of fateful realization torpedoed a fleet of families. The realization? Jerry did not have access to sufficient family funds. Not to worry. Funds were in Jerry's father's wallet. So the focus of amorous attention shifted to a different wallet, a man. You may find this hard to believe, but April won Jerry's father, divorced Jerry, and married the father, who had also divorced Jerry's mother in order to complete this little opera. Well, few battles are won without an exchange of cannon fire, so every form of lawsuit possible was launched. The newspaper in the town of Bumbershoot had enough front page material to form legends. Soon, and you could predict this, the costs of litigation and time drove the company and its owner into bankruptcy. By the time April achieved her goal, the goal no longer existed. She had trashed one of the finest persons I had ever met for an old man who had now nothing. She moved with her new and virtually penniless husband to California. The only reason I know that is because the phone rang at my grandfather's house during a Christmas meal. April's dad was there. The call, collect for him from April, pled for enough money to leave California and come back to Bumbershoot. Well, what I learned from watching this event unfold cannot be properly communicated in this story. However, the story does not end with this final phone call. April had no place to keep her personal treasures, including her opulent wedding dress, so she stored them with my grandparents, and she finally disappeared, abandoning everything she had. Years later, when I found Tennessee's best and convinced her to marry me, she had everything to fulfill my dreams for a wife, except for one thing. She was as poor as I was. Not wanting to burden our parents, through generosity of friends and special deals, our wedding plans proceeded. But what to do for a dress? Wedding dresses are horribly expensive. Not to worry. My grandmother shipped to us an abandoned dress whose finery exceeded everything in the wedding except the bride, whom it fit perfectly. I think God has a sense of humor. Discussion questions. How do you think this situation could have been rescued? Number two. Have you ever tried to achieve something and found it to be much less fulfilling than you expected? Can you describe it? Number three. Would you rather that I not have covered the pain of this story with humor? Have you ever been in a painful situation in which you resented attempts at humor? Read the story again and retell it in your own words. The story, A Mystical Moment. Serving a small church in a southern town stretched me in many ways. The congregation, composed mostly of very old and very young, with a few in between, was controlled by the arch-conservative old. Since the young go-getters were mostly Air Force personnel whose lives were highly mobile and unsettled. Amazingly, one young chap from an army base 50 miles away began hiring a taxi on Sunday mornings and bringing some of his buddies to church. He spoke often and glowingly of his home church on the West Coast. He kept saying, "They would like you at my church. I wish you'd visit there." It so happened that my wife and I were going to a conference on the West Coast, so he gave us his parents' phone number and insisted that I call them. When we arrived, I called and they made the hour-long journey down to see us. We met and chatted in the lobby of the convention center. He, the head deacon of their church, and his wife were anxious to hear reports about their son. Then the mystical moment happened. As we talked, a thought so strong that it almost took wings and flew out of my mouth. "I'm going to be your pastor someday." I controlled myself, though, and we parted. I chuckled at the craziness of such a thought for me, a mere 26-year-old beginner. With hesitation, I shared that crazy thought with my wife. She was amused. We returned to our church to find that the army fella had been sent to Vietnam. We would not see him again. 3 years later, life moved us to a new location, eastward. My wife and I laughed that we were going the wrong direction if my thoughts were true. 2 years later, a dramatic development sent us packing again, to the north. We laughed again, wrong direction. Now, on the headquarters staff of a denomination, our minds were dominated by the excitement of creating youth magazines. The West Coast dropped completely out of our minds. 8 years passed with no further contact with that deacon or the church after the meeting in that lobby. The main magazine I developed for youth had been greatly successful, and I settled into the routine of the office, although every weekend I was flying off somewhere to speak. On one of those routine days, I sat in my corner office looking at my commanding view of a parking lot, real prestige here, folks, when the phone rang. On the line was the deacon I had met 8 years earlier. I couldn't believe what I heard. We're without a pastor, and your name keeps being recommended to us. We think you're the one. So would you come out to speak to us and be interviewed? Well, he didn't remember who I was, and now he was inviting me to consider being his pastor. The phone seemed to melt in my hand. I agreed to be there 1 month later. The church building seated 2,000, but walled off segments of the auditorium made the 130, mostly elderly people in attendance, look slightly less lost. Two other, much more vigorous ethnic churches used the building, which was downtown in a major city. The head deacon voiced strong views against both of those ethnic groups, and I knew that my first clash would be with him. I began to shudder. In the interview, my vision as a pastor fell on unreceptive ears. The 3 months necessary for me to arrive, though I was willing to fly out and speak each Sunday, seemed like the final straw. The interview didn't exactly close, it just ceased. Sunday night, I found an alone time and stood in front of the church looking at the neighborhood, thoroughly confused and praying. Lord, you know I'll come here if that's what you want. But our hearts are not at all together. If I came, the agony I'm feeling would be multiplied by the agony they would feel. So please don't let this work out unless your kingdom will truly benefit. I flew home knowing I would probably never hear from them. I didn't. My wife felt that I had probably missed the will of God somehow in my interview. I struggled in my mind to establish a reason for the whole procession of events. My emotions were in some disarray since I had been so convinced that I would be moving there that I had released all my current ministry from my heart. I was in limbo. Perhaps the release in my heart was the purpose of this long-term drama. I didn't know that a large and powerful wave was thundering toward me that a year and a half later would deposit me on the West Coast, 90 minutes away from that church. The next 6 years after my visit to that church were filled with my greatest agonies and my greatest ecstasies, with my greatest successes and my greatest failures. All of this punctuated with an occasional question from my wife that maybe I had missed the voice of God by not going to that church. Near the end of that 6 years, a rare Sunday free of assignment slid into my schedule. Such an unscheduled Sunday was so unusual, we didn't exactly know what to do. Honey, I have an idea. Why don't we drive to the church where I interviewed 6 years ago and just see what's happening? The idea met full approval of the family. We introduced ourselves to the greeter at the door. No recognition in his eyes. We wanted to be anonymous, but were welcomed and introduced in part of the service. Yeah, we were still anonymous. No one remembered. The service was identical to 6 years earlier. They were jubilant in announcing that they had 130 present. On the way home, my wife put my heart at rest. Honey, you did the right thing. From this and other personal events, as well as the observation of others, I have come to deeply distrust the mystical, but keep an open mind when it comes to determining the voice of God. However, when it comes to truly hearing from God and fulfilling His will, nothing beats reading the Bible and making Jesus-style choices. Discussion. Have you ever had strong thoughts or expectations that fail to come about? How did you react? Number two. What do you think when someone says, God told me? Number three. How would you handle a situation where two or three people said they had heard from God, yet each had a different plan or program to present? The story, Outloved. As I taught one of my college classroom sessions, a brilliant student stated that when he was in high school, he knew every question to ask anyone who tried to witness to him. In fact, he said he could have anyone doubting their faith inside 30 minutes. "So why are you a Christian then?" I asked. "Well," he said, "I joined the army, and at the base where I was stationed, there was a group of guys who really loved God and loved each other and loved me. I couldn't resist." "But what about those questions?" I replied. "What questions?" "Oh, those. Unimportant," was his answer. So here was a brilliant person who was not brought to Christ by someone out-brillianting him, but simply by some people out-loving him. The leader of the group of Christians at that base is now my son-in-law, Peter Robbins. Am I blessed or am I blessed? Discussion. How did you come to a relationship with God? Number two. If others were involved in bringing you to Jesus, what is your relationship with them today? Number three. What do you think is the most effective form of evangelism? The story, the professor. Los Angeles to Amsterdam flights last forever. So I sat grateful for the upgrade to business class and grateful for the PowerBook laptop, which was a gift from some friends that I was working with during the flight. A man across the aisle noticed my computer and inquired if I had a spare battery. He grinned sheepishly and said he had exhausted his playing games and still needed to work. I apologized that I didn't have one, but the ice was broken. Later, when I finished and stood up to stretch, we began to talk computers, then life. He was a professor at the University of Southern California and on his way to Holland for a visit. He, of course, asked what I did. "I have more fun than anybody," I told him. "I travel all over the world teaching on the nature of Jesus." "Well, I'm an atheist," came his curt reply. "Really? Are you really an atheist?" "Yes." "Tell me, how did you, a professor at the University of Southern California, come to the conclusion that there is no God?" I took him by surprise. Probably for the first time, he was being asked to justify his disbelief. University systems rarely require you to justify your atheism, only your Christianity. He stumbled for a few seconds, so I continued. "I can't look at the vastness of space and the intricacy of a cell without thinking there must be a designer, a mind behind all of this." "Okay, mister, you've got a point." "So I guess really I'm an agnostic." "Well, that's movement, but tell me how you, a professor at the University of Southern California, came to the conclusion that you cannot know whether there's a God or not." "Look, mister, I have a system. I believe in life." "Great, so do I." I knew what he meant by life, so I pressed on. "Do you have a tree at your house?" "Yes." "What if I were to come and strip some leaves off your tree? What would you do about that?" "Oh, I would be upset." "Because it's life, right?" "Yeah." "But you really wouldn't do anything to me." "No, I guess not." "Do you have any children?" "Yes." "What if I came and killed one of them? What would you do?" "Now that's different." "But it's just life, unless there is different life." "Do you have a fireplace?" "Yes." "What do you burn in it?" "Look, mister, I buy it." "Aha, so you hire a killer. Are you wearing leather shoes?" "Yeah." "Kill something for that, didn't you?" "Touché, mister." By this point, the stewardess had moved us twice because of complaints of passengers who wanted to sleep. Now we stood behind the galley and next to the toilets on this 747. "Okay, mister. I'm a seeker. I would love to have what you have, but I don't know how." He listened to the gospel carefully, asking questions. Though he did not make a decision at that point, he accepted my card and a copy of the Jesus Style. Even atheists want to know what God is like. Discussion. What was your most memorable witnessing experience? 2. What intimidates you most about witnessing? 3. To whom would you most like to witness? The story, Maud and Mary. Ada and I drove, as part of our sentimental journey, to Choctaw Ridge. Perhaps you remember the song that contained the line, "And Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge." I was baptized in the Tallahatchie River. If Billy Joe jumped off the bridge, he might have sprained an ankle. That song also speaks of Choctaw Ridge, a place of great and warm memories. My family faced deprivation one winter, not knowing how we would get food. A hillbilly on Choctaw Ridge named Mode Corder heard of our plight and told us that if we were willing to pick them, he had enough beans in his hills for us to eat. We were willing. Mode and Mary Corder became a joyous part of our lives. Mode was 72 years old and could not read or write. He told me he had gone to school 2 days in his life. The first day he learned how to court, the second day he learned how to fight, and that was all he needed to know, so he quit. Well, his stories were a delight, but his actions were hilarious. About every 6 months, he would don his best clothes. He never wore shoes unless he came to town or church. And we would head into town for a day. He loved the dime store. He'd find a place to sit and simply watch people and the store all day long. Some who came in thought him to be a salesman or the manager of the store. Well, he played along. He would duly explain different items to help people make decisions, though he knew nothing about what he was doing. Job hunters would see him and, assuming him to be the manager, apply for a job. He would listen, ask certain questions, then tell them that they were just who he was looking for and to report to work on Monday. By Monday, he was safely back up on the ridge. Chaos. One story might have been true, but it stretched my ability to believe just a bit. Mary was only 12 when he married her, that's true, and could not cook. Now that's true. Mode reports that he bought a month's supply of cooking materials, locked her in the kitchen, and told her not to come out until she could cook. Eh, maybe. If she failed with a batch on her wood stove, she was to throw it out the window to the hogs and start again. Eh, perhaps. Whether that happened or not, Mary was a world-class cook. That's true. I wanted to take their picture with my rudimentary flashless camera, so it had to be done outside. Mode called the hogs against the protests of Mary, so they could be in the picture too. We're hillbillies, Mary, and the picture will look more natural if the hogs are there. There was life in them thar hills. Discussion. Who do you know that you would call a colorful personality? What makes them colorful? 2. If you've ever had a time of financial deprivation, how in that circumstance did you see the hand of God? 3. Do Mode and Mary meet your definition of hillbillies? Where have you found stereotypes such as Yankee or Southerner or country boy to be inaccurate? The story, Dirty Pictures. Like many other rides to airports or next stops, my driver, an old friend, and I talked of many things, dissecting life and meaning. We rejoice in each other's company after years of not seeing each other. The conversation shifted, as it often does, to an area of need and growth. I have a problem, a decision I need to make, and maybe you can help me. Hardly a trip goes by without hearing those words. However, unshockable me was a bit unprepared for what I was about to hear. I have some pictures at my house that I'm thinking God might want me to get rid of, my friend blurted out. I've had them for a while, but now I'm becoming concerned about what could happen if some people saw them. I know it would damage how they see me, and I might not be able to minister to them properly if they see them. Mixed emotions flooded my soul. Could my friend not see clearly what was being said? Was there any question, really, about the removal of the pictures? What could I say? Before I could respond, my friend continued, I know this is a lust problem for me, and I need to do something about it. I certainly don't get any satisfaction from them. What do you think I should do? Squirming a bit, I struggled to stay cool and calm, hoping that simple logic might handle the situation. Well, did God tell you to put these pictures up? I asked. No, but God didn't tell me to put up the pictures of my mom and dad either. But God hasn't convicted you about the pictures of mom and dad. True. But he is speaking to you about these other pictures. Yeah. There has to be more to this, I thought, so I pursued the question. Well, why would you put them up in the first place? Well, they do represent some power to me. They do symbolize challenges and successful conquest. Well, wouldn't you rather let God reward you as a victor and conqueror than to look at and remember this? I knew that my friend was single and the pressures of life could be unbearable at times, but I hoped the conviction being felt would produce some sort of repentance. We drove on. Thoughts swirled thick enough to cut with a knife. Occasionally, my friend would just say, it's so difficult, I just don't know. Finally, hesitantly, the thoughts and questions found completion. The victory was won. My friend went home and took her pictures down. The one with her standing beside a former president as he signed a bill. The one with her standing by a Supreme Court justice. The one with her and a famous performer. The lust to be seen with famous and powerful people had been conquered. She only wanted to be known because of her relationship with Jesus. Discussion. Would you ever consider publicity or seen with famous people photos to be dirty pictures? How does someone's image affect how you relate to them? Number three. What types of photos would you expect God to convict you about?